Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Number one, I don't think Ben Bernanke actually said what he said, people. Which gets us to number two, pay no attention to the stock market. And then finally, number three, this is Friday, right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer or mobile device instantly streamed by Netflix to save you time, money, and hassle. Free 30-day trial now at netflix.com/APM.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. This is the Marketplace Podcast for the 21st of June. It's a Friday. Great to have you with us. And listen, is it just me or has this been a long week? The Fed meets, Wall Street goes nuts. I don't know. Monday just feels like it was a good long while ago. And that's where we're going to start our weekly wrap. Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville is in our studios in New York. Neela Richardson from Bloomberg Government is down in Washington, D.C. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, so Neela, let me ask you this. Ben Bernanke gives his press conference on Wednesday after the Fed meets. He says generally positive things, I believe. Wall Street goes bananas. Here's my question. Did Bernanke muddle the message or did Wall Street overreact?
I think Wall Street overreacted. It was almost as if Bernanke punched Wall Street in the collective gut. Ooh. And that's not what his intention was. He said very clearly, I thought, that the Fed would begin to taper if and only if the fundamentals right. looked good. Not good enough. Good.
Tapering is the gradual reinstatement of interest rates going up and stop buying and all that stuff. Exactly. Mr. Garcia, sir, agree, yeah. Disagree?
I agree, although okay. I also think he muddled the message. So he muddled the message, and in part because of that, Wall Street overreacted. So I took away two main things once you cut through sort of all the clutter. One is that he really does expect the economy to improve even more than he expected it a few months ago. And because of that, that's why he thinks it's appropriate to start slowing down the pace at which the Fed supports the economy later this year. But he made another point, as Neela said, which is that if it doesn't meet his expectations, then he's willing to adjust the pace at which he either slows down or if it gets really bad, he'll even increase it, right? Yeah. The problem is that the market's completely ignored the second point. And I think part of that is a little bit on him because he didn't make it clear really what he'd be watching for. And when you make a policy like that that's variable, that's contingent on the economy achieving certain states, then you have to explain what those states are. He didn't really do that. And so I'm not too shocked that markets reacted.
All right, Neela, climb in here. I can hear you with that sharp intake.
No, the hard truth is, and Bernanke unfortunately used this analogy, this is going to be like landing on an aircraft carrier. There isn't any clear signals about what the economy is going to give the Fed to make the Fed feel comfortable to pull back off that gas pedal. Yeah. And so they're going to look at a variety of things, and collectively they're going to get a view of the economy. And that view could change from quarter to quarter.
All right, Cardiff, one more quick question on the Fed, actually. What's going to happen next time Bernanke has one of these press conferences? Is he going to be more deliberate, careful, you know?
I think he will. I think he'll be more forceful. He'll reintroduce some of the boldness and clarity that he had, you know, been introducing into Federal Reserve communications policy in the last year or two. And by the way, there might be one silver lining from what's happened in the last couple of days, which is that some of the distortions and the vulnerabilities in the markets have now been exposed. So when inevitably the economy does get better and the tapering actually does begin, markets might be a little bit better prepared to deal with it.
All right. Well, fingers crossed on that one. Yeah, no, exactly.
Yeah, let's hope.
All right. Changing gears here. Neela, the G8 was this past week. The president went to Ireland. They had communiques on tax evasion in Syria and this and that. I remember when the G8 used to be a big fat wingding and everybody paid attention and it really mattered in the global economy. And now you're like, yawn, right?
Right. The G8 has now become an old man's club where they play chess and talk about the weather. No. There are some important things that are going on in terms of the West getting their message together on tax evasion. But in terms of real economic change and policy, you need the BRICS at the table. You need China, Brazil, and India. And so the G20 has surpassed the G8 in terms of importance and global significance.
Cardiff, let me actually just springboard off of that for a second and talk about China, which had a little bit of vulnerability this week. There were some interest rate moves over there. I don't want to get too far down in the weeds, but people got nervous about the Chinese economy. Are you?
I am. And You know, it is. It's impossible to say exactly what's going to happen. But that itself is one of the problems. There isn't a whole lot of transparency about what the Chinese central bank and the Chinese government think is happening in credit markets right now. And the worry is, and it's, you know, it's probably not going to happen, but it's a non-trivial worry, is that China ends up with a credit crunch of a similar magnitude to China that the U.S. and other rich economies had a few years ago. But it's still way too early to say.
Yeah, that would be non-trivial, dude. I mean, come on.
Yes,
right?
It would be. I'm saying there's a non-trivial chance it'll happen. I still think it's a low probability chance, but there's a chance, and that's no good.
All right. Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville and Neil Richardson from Bloomberg Government down in Washington. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks,
have a good
right,
weekend.
We'll see you. Have a good weekend. You too. On Wall Street today, things were tame, actually, relatively speaking. We'll have the details when we always have the details. Shares of Oracle took a drubbing on the NASDAQ today, off 9-something percent on what you can really only call a lousy earnings report. But that's not why I mentioned that. The part of the story that interests us today is the NASDAQ part. Oracle said this week it's going to move from the NASDAQ over to the big board, the New York Stock Exchange, the NYSE, if you will, because the company says it's, quote, in the best interests of its stockholders, customers, and partners. So, exchanges make a difference. Why? Marketplace's Sabri Benishour explains.
Part of this is about image. Eugene White is professor of economics at Rutgers University. He says historically, the New York Stock Exchange was more of a blue chip club with established, less volatile stocks.
Once you're inside this club, it looks like you're more stable.
That could translate into more share value. Oracle could also be targeting a different type of trader at NYSE and different financial instruments like derivatives, says MIT professor of strategy Pailing Yin.
Perhaps a more international group, perhaps a group of traders who are interested in many more different array of financial instruments that are trading on NYSE.
But really, this may also be a case of good old-fashioned poaching.
I'll take your man.
The initiative for this move, I think, came from NYSE. I don't think it came from Oracle.
The New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ are always battling over attracting big companies. They'll offer lower listing fees or other discounts, says Yin.
I think Oracle got a good deal and they took it.
So, for example, last year, NASDAQ landed Facebook, Kraft Foods, and Goodyear. This is New York Stock Exchange's way of hitting back.
The fundamental economics behind an exchange is the more traders I have, the more that companies want to list on my exchange. And the more companies that I have listed on my exchange, the more traders I can attract.
And the more fees it can charge everyone. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
What follows, I will tell you in advance, right up front, is one of those glass half full, glass half empty kinds of stories. The FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, has, as you may have heard, been considering what many airline passengers thought would never come, whether to let people keep their gadgets powered up during an entire flight, takeoff, landing, the whole smash. Well, the Wall Street Journal reports today it could happen as soon as September, which means many of you may soon run out of excuses to stop working even briefly. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports on an entirely different kind of nonstop flight.
Let's just say Henry Feintuck doesn't like getting on airplanes.
Makes me feel out of control, insignificant, and frustrated.
Feintuck runs a New York PR firm, but with clients all over, he flies 2 to 3 times a month. What makes the businessman so miserable?
Your mobile phones and other electronic devices should be turned off.
See, when Feintuck powers down, he feels like he may as well be dead. He says staying plugged in during taxiing, takeoffs, and landings could mean salvaging a business meeting with a quick text.
Tell him the answer is yes, or no problem, we'll go that way. But by not being able to communicate that, I'm out of the loop.
That loop can stretch as long as 75 minutes if you're stuck on a nightmare on the runway at O'Hare or LAX. But even if it's just 15 to 20 minutes, career counselor Marty Nemko says the extra time is a windfall.
We all are asked to do more with less. And if we can get our email answered while we're in the plane, as opposed to sitting there and just waiting for the plane to land or watching the stupid movie, should we not be celebrating?
Maybe not. That windfall can also mean extra time for your boss to pester you with more demands or to spend on that scintillating spreadsheet instead of catching up with Brad and Angie in Vanity Fair. Jonathan Spira has written a book about information overload and how it can hurt your business.
Even if the FAA allows you to turn it on, don't. Relax, enjoy your pre-departure beverage, and just enjoy the time.
That may be hard when I could be gaining powerful insight from the latest bestseller on my e-reader, 87 Quick Ways to Think Yourself Rich. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
The Paris Air Show opened to the public today, which is nice for the public and all. Lots of cool planes to see. But the truth is, the business end of the thing has been going on all week. Boeing and Airbus and makers of all kinds of smaller planes hawking their wares. The aerospace industry is a big deal, economy-wise, which, as Christopher Worth reports, explains the list of attendees.
You expect to hear the French national anthem at the Paris Air Show. But at this ribbon-cutting ceremony at the American Pavilion, the Star-Spangled Banner is loud and clear.
And the rocket's red glare.
The United States has the largest pavilion at the show. And amid all the plane makers, defense companies, and parts manufacturers, the place is crawling with American elected officials, including this guy.
I'm Richard Shelby, and it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in a rainy day.
Shelby is the senior senator from Alabama. He's a regular attendee who's leading a delegation of 6 senators to the show. Ask an American politician what justifies coming to Paris, and Shelby's response is a lot like others.
There are 400 American companies represented here, including people that are tied to thousands of jobs in America.
Yes, they always cite American jobs, and this at a time of reduced U.S. military spending. The U.S. Air Force couldn't afford to display a single aircraft at the show. Marion Blakey of the Aerospace Industries Association says that's why being at an international trade show is all the more important this year for American aerospace companies.
The federal budget cuts that we're having in the United States argues for more attention to exporting.
For example, France has struck a deal to buy American-made drones. And in this business, it's not just about the price of an aircraft. Blakey says a senator's handshake instills trust in American products abroad.
Members of Congress, they understand that we're going to have to be out there marketing what the United States has to offer very aggressively if we're going to stay competitive on a worldwide basis.
But some take issue with that.
We don't elect these people to actually be hucksters and salesmen of American private sector wares.
Steve Ellis is with the Washington-based Taxpayers for Common Sense. He questions the costs of trips like these.
Anytime we look at these congressional delegations, we have to ask ourselves, is this really more like a de facto vacation? It is Paris, and they're still going to the cafes, and they're still being put up on the taxpayer's dime in some nice hotel and wining and dining with their spouse and a bunch of staff.
None of the Senate offices contacted answered questions on costs. But what's most noticeable at the air show is the battle between U.S. states for the same American jobs. I spoke with a number of American governors in Paris.
My name's Martin O'Malley. I'm the Democratic governor of Maryland.
I'm Jay Nixon, the governor of the state of Missouri.
Sam Brownback, governor of Kansas.
I'm Governor Mary Fallon from the state of Oklahoma.
22 states have booths at the show this year. Governors like Fallon meet with companies like Boeing and Airbus and parts suppliers. They offer tax breaks and infrastructure investments and a cutthroat competition to bring work to their states.
Frankly, for states that aren't at the show, they're missing opportunities because when they're not here, I am here, and I am here getting the business.
Oklahoma expects to spend roughly $50,000 in state funds on the Paris Air Show. And Fallon says it's worth every penny. In Paris, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
Coming up,
use the Force, Lego Luke.
Star Wars and Harry Potter were tremendously popular for Lego, but at the same time, they almost put the company out of business.
But first, let's do the numbers.
Rebound would be too kind, but the Dow Industrials picked up 0.2% today, 41 points, closed at 14,799. The NASDAQ dipped 0.2%, 7 points, 3,357, the number you're looking for there. The S&P 500 tipped up 0.2%, 4 points, ended things at 1592 for the week. Yeah, no, I don't want to relive it either, but here you go. The Dow off 1.8%, the NASDAQ let go of 1.9%, the S&P 500 down 2.1%. Druids may be celebrating the summer solstice, not so the solar industry. Sun Edison dimmed nearly 3% today. First Solar powered down nearly 1.5%. Sacred Sun Power dimmed 0.8%. Nothing but clouds over financial firm Citigroup, off 2% today. Bond prices fell yet again. The yield on the 10-year T-note, here it comes, 2.54%, people. You're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. Streamed now by Netflix, a great value. Netflix Streaming has lots of movie and television options, including past seasons of House of Cards, Breaking Bad, and Arrested Development. Watch them using Netflix Instant Streaming and find thousands of other TV series and movies during your free 30-day trial at Netflix.com/APM.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Secretary of State John Kerry will be in New Delhi as he continues a 12-day tour overseas. It's an occasion to wear all white. The tennis tournament Wimbledon gets underway in London. And Sally Ride, the first American woman in space, landed safely back on Earth at Edwards Air Force Base 30 years ago. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Just because there's not enough to watch on television, there's a new show debuting this weekend. Devious Maids premieres Sunday night. It's a comedy, drama, mystery kind of thing, sort of like Desperate Housewives, which is, in fact, the audience that this show is targeting. The protagonists, though, in this one are all Latinas. A good marketing hook, possibly, except for the way that's playing out in reality, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
The show Devious Maids is already available online. You can watch in English as a rich white woman dresses down her servant.
If you don't stop screwing my husband, I'm going to have you deported. Comprende?
Or you can watch it in Spanish.
Si no dejas de acostarte con mi esposo, haré que te deporten. ¿Comprendes?
Rob Chernow is general manager of Lifetime Network, which will air Devious Maids.
We think there's a big opportunity to tap into the Hispanic market. Currently, there's literally no show on television outside of Spanish language television that features Latino stars.
But some Latina bloggers have taken issue with the show. One describes it as, quote, kind of like a crappy Desperate Housewives Latina redux, unquote. And that's the nice review. Others have accused Devious Maids of stereotyping Latinas. But Chernow says a lot of the criticism has come from people who haven't seen the show.
Anyone who sees the show knows immediately that the maids are the heroines and they have all the virtue. It is a very aspirational portrait of the maids and sort of a relatively villainous portrait of everyone else.
Perhaps the show is being taken too seriously. It is, after all, a soap opera, or telenovela in Spanish. It's meant to be fun and sexy. And for Lifetime, Chernow says Devious Maids is meant to attract younger viewers.
We definitely are not your grandmother's Lifetime. We've already lowered our median age significantly year on year.
One group you might expect to take exception with the show are real-life maids. But the stereotypes don't bother Socorro Castellanos. She's been a domestic worker for 16 years. Castellanos does note real maids generally don't dress up at work.
We have to dress very modestly because we work with infants and also with elderly people.
On the show, one maid gets involved in a murder mystery. In real life, the mystery is how maids will get paid for all the time they work. Leili Davari is a community organizer with the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights of Los Angeles.
So many of our domestic workers are working more than 40 hours a week and only getting paid for those 40 hours. So no overtime. Another thing, there are no personal sick days.
A bill that would help protect domestic servants has made its way to California's Senate. Advocates would like Devious Maids executive producer Eva Longoria to lobby for the legislation. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
All right, let's do a little new media review here, shall we? Facebook, you know, it's where you share posts with your friends. Facebook owns Instagram, a photo app that lets you style your photos. Twitter is where you write pithy notes to share with the world. Twitter owns Vine, a video app that lets you record 6-second videos. Now, Instagram has added video, and everybody's a Twitter. Yeah, I'm going to pass this one off to Adrienne Hill and let her explain.
If I were to do this story as a Vine video with only 6 seconds, it'd go something like this.
You can now make 15-second videos using Instagram. Advertisers will jump in, but Facebook will benefit in another big way, the end.
Instagram offers videos with an extra 9 seconds. It sounds really small, but
it's a huge difference.
Richard Cochi Hernandez is a new media professor at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism.
So your story or your message can be a little longer, a little funner, which is always nice.
The Instagram video version of my story goes something like this.
You can now make 15-second videos using Instagram, which, if you've been champing at the bit to make an old-timey film of your toddler, is huge news. Advertisers will no doubt love this too, but analysts say Facebook is after another valuable commodity, your personal information. The end.
Better, right? Hernandez says the extra time isn't always a bonus.
9 more seconds of, you know, the foam in your cappuccino could potentially, you know, turn people off.
He thinks there's going to be room for both Vine and Instagram videos. Some analysts expect marketers will love the extra seconds, more space to sell whatever they're selling. But Nate Elliott from Forrester says for Facebook, adding video to Instagram is all about the data.
The more Facebook gets people onto Instagram, the more they get people using Instagram, the more data those people are generating. And it's the data that's really valuable to Facebook and ultimately to marketers as well.
Doesn't every story about Facebook kind of end this way? I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Quick, see if you can think of a Danish company that's a worldwide brand that's loved by consumers of all ages and is on store shelves pretty much everywhere. Parents of young children, or actually anybody who's ever been a young child, should get this. It's Legos, right? Dave Robertson writes about the company, its near death, and how it came back in his new book. It's called Brick by Brick. Dave, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So listen, Star Wars and Harry Potter, that for me was when Lego kind of went downhill, I got to tell you.
Really? Why?
Yeah. The blocks are good, and I loved them as a kid, and my kids love them, but then it just got carried away. And I think, actually, the evidence in the book bears that out, right?
Absolutely true. The Star Wars and Harry Potter were tremendously popular for Lego, but at the same time, they almost put the company out of business. That Star Wars and Harry Potter were really popular in the years in which there was a movie. But Lego, which had been in the middle of this huge burst of innovation in the late 90s and early 2000s, had kind of innovated beyond what it could manage, and Lego almost went bankrupt.
The problems, though, were deeper than just not having the sales of this toy, right? I mean, there were management problems, there were accounting problems. You go into some detail in this book. I mean, these guys didn't even have a way to track monthly financials. I mean, it was bad.
Yeah, and to some degree, they're a victim of their own success. The Lego as we know it really took off in the late 70s when the grandson of the founder, Kjell Kirk, took over. And he did a couple of innovations like Duplo and Technique, mm-hmm. and the minifigure all came out in
Duplo
the first.
Duplo are the big ones, right? Those
Duplo, yeah, right. It's the bigger bricks for smaller hands. Right. And Technique is the more complex Lego with gears and motors and axles and the whole idea being that teenagers would play with Lego, you know, instead of leaving the brand. And actually, by the way, that failed.
Yeah, shocking. Teenagers Come on, right?
Didn't play with Lego, but 25 to 55-year-old men loved it. So
that's a whole different thing.
The brand did tremendously well.
There's a great chart in here, actually, speaking about innovation and how they grew and all that. And I can't find it now. I'm flipping through and I can't find it. About how many different elements Lego produced, and they got up to 14,200 different elements, by which I am interpreting that to mean like individual little brick elements and helmets and this and that, right?
That's right. And there was a big debate in the company, even when they're almost at bankruptcy, between the people, the designers, who said, we want all these different alternatives. We want all these different shapes and colors because we need them to design toys. And then the manufacturing supply chain people were saying, the complexity is killing us. You know, we got to cut it in half. And what won the day is there was a guy named Henrik Weiss-Olbeck who brought into a management meeting a set of chefs and policemen and bad guys from different sets. And they're all different, but not very different. And what he said is that some of the designers were actually designing the minifigures to look like themselves. They were immortalizing themselves in Lego.
I love that. But I have to tell you, when I go shopping now for a birthday present for a party that my 9-year-old is going to, I basically say, yeah, we'll just run down to the toy store and we'll get one of those Lego things. And it's whether it's some little robotic thing or some assembly kit or whatever it is, it's almost you can just grab one and go. And I guess that's good business, but where's the charm?
And it's amazing that you do that, given that on that same toy shelf, there's probably a brick available that snaps with a Lego brick for half the cost. Mm. But you're looking for Lego.
Dave Robertson is a professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. His most recent book is called Brick by Brick. It's about Lego. Dave, thanks a bunch.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, updating an item we mentioned earlier this week. Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, said today that if Bob Kraft, the owner of the New England Patriots, is going to keep on whining about that Super Bowl ring that Putin allegedly, quote unquote, stole back in 2005, well then, Putin is just going to get him a replacement. Putin told the AFP today, the Agence France-Presse, you know, I do not remember either Mr. Kraft or the ring, but, he went on, we will craft a really good, noticeable thing so it is clear that it is expensive, made of a good metal with a rock, so that this jewel is passed on from generation to generation in the team whose interest Mr. Kraft represents. Comrade. All right, no, he didn't say that last part. We're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. JJ Yor is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We'll see you back here on Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.